Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Bitcoin's ability to create an open, peaceful, and transparent society may actually be dependent on its capacity to obfuscate or create anonymity and privacy in the exchanges that it enables. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the show. I don't have a whole lot of time to go over stuff right now because we are starting our trek through the Coin Center report by Jerry Brito, and it's titled The Case for Electronic Cash: Why Private Peer-to-Peer Payments Are Essential to an Open Society. So because I'm a little low on time today, and I'm not 100% sure I still don't know how many episodes this is going to take. It'll just kind of depend on my schedule for the next couple of days. But this is going to be a really, really good one. I think you guys are going to enjoy this, and there's going to be lots of fun discussion. So without further ado, I think I'm just going to jump in today, and we are going to see how far we can get. And maybe I'll have some time for commentary today, but if not, we will definitely have some in the next coming episodes. All right, so without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into the report from Coin Center written by Jerry Brito, The Case for Electronic Cash. Abstract. Cash is more than a method of payment. It is a fundamental tool for individual privacy and autonomy, and it is necessary for an open society. This paper shows that a cashless economy is a surveillance economy. It also argues that removing the option to freely transact without intermediation greatly limits our economic self-determination, placing our economic lives in the hands of financial institutions and governments. This paper presents several case studies demonstrating the dangers of a completely intermediated payment system and concludes that electronic cash is a tool that should not only be tolerated, but fostered and celebrated. Author, Jerry Brito, Executive Director at Coin Center. About Coin Center. Coin Center is a nonprofit research and advocacy center focused on the public policy issues facing open blockchain technologies, such as Bitcoin. Our mission is to build a better understanding of these technologies and to promote a regulatory climate that preserves the freedom to innovate using blockchain technologies. We do this by producing and publishing policy research from respected academics and experts, educating policymakers and the media about blockchain technology, and by engaging in advocacy for sound public policy. Introduction. Completely anonymous cryptocurrency is an experimental new technology that is being perfected by the day. While it is tempting to only focus on the opportunities it presents to criminals and its inevitable illicit uses, more important is what it represents for the law-abiding citizens that make up the vast majority of society. Not only do its benefits outweigh its costs, electronic cash is indeed essential to sustaining a liberal, open society. In a world without cash, a bearer and peer-to-peer form of money, all transactions must be necessarily intermediated by financial institutions. Intermediated transactions are by their nature subject to surveillance and control. If third-party financial institutions must be part of all transactions, then they will be privy to the intimate details of everyone's financial life. They can also choose to disallow certain transactions and potentially even certain persons from transacting. Intermediation has many benefits, including efficiency and convenience. Used responsibly, the information gleaned from the privileged position of financial intermediary can also allow one to better extend credit, prevent fraud, and help the authorities fight crime. But as this paper will show, It can also be abused spectacularly by corporations and governments. If there is no way to avoid intermediation, then individuals will have no way to preserve their privacy or their autonomy. Cash is an ancient technology that allows us to avoid intermediation and thus to preserve the values necessary for the individual liberty and human dignity. While we are a long way from a cashless and completely intermediated existence, at least in the United States, this paper will also show that there is a concerted effort to eliminate cash that has been quite successful in other parts of the world. This paper will argue that cash is essential to an open society. It is an escape valve in our increasingly intermediated and therefore surveilled world. We do not argue that cash should be the only option for transactions, or even the option one should choose most of the time, but it should be an option. Without it, there is no choice but to have one's every purchase be watched and recorded and the information used without one's consent. Without cash, there is no exit, no chance for the kind of dignity-preserving privacy that undergirds an open society. Cash is also necessary to retain agency and autonomy. Autonomy can be understood as the power to make decisions for oneself without interference from others. It's the ability to try things one's way, to succeed and be rewarded, or to make mistakes and learn from them. As with personal privacy, without individual autonomy, there can be no meaningful open society. It is therefore imperative that we preserve our ability to use it. Yet, that is not enough. As we move to an increasingly online world in which physical cash is not practical for many transactions, we must also develop and foster electronic cash that is as privacy-preserving and permissionless as physical cash. While this will have costs as well as benefits, we argue that the way to address the cost is not to prohibit electronic cash, but instead to regulate its use no differently than physical cash, for which there is a robust regime. What is cash? Cash is not simply money. The word cash typically refers to money in the form of coins and paper notes. It is distinct from other forms of money, such as demand deposits, which is money held in bank accounts, and from which one can pay using a check. Paper notes and coins, on the other hand, are bearer instruments. That means that whoever has physical possession of the tokens, in this case the notes or the coins, is presumed to be the owner of the money, and ownership is transferred by simply handing over physical possession of the token. Cash transactions are peer-to-peer, transferring ownership of a house, a car, a stock, or bond registered in one's name, or even money in one's bank account, requires the involvement of a third party, such as a bank, a stock transfer agent, or a local register of deeds. A cash transaction, on the other hand, happens only between the two parties to the transaction. I hand you a $100 note, and that's all there is to it. The bearer and peer-to-peer nature of cash means that transactions require little or no trust. You may still want to verify that the cash in hand is not counterfeit. Footnote: the U.S. Treasury Department estimates that about only one note in every 10,000 is counterfeit. But there is no trust in third parties necessary for the transaction. In contrast, when you accept a check, you trust that the bank is solvent and will honor the order to pay. Because it is bearer and peer-to-peer, cash is also permissionless. This means that one does not need authorization from or an account with any institution in order to transact with others. This is important for many persons who cannot easily open such an account, perhaps because they don't have steady income, a good credit history, a government ID, or a permanent address. In some countries, like Saudi Arabia, women are not allowed to open accounts. Cash is an open access system in which anyone, banked or unbanked, can participate without having to seek the permission of financial gatekeepers. Because cash is permissionless, it is censorship resistant. You can use cash to contribute to an unpopular cause or to purchase goods or services that are legal but socially or culturally taboo. Of course, it can also be used to buy illicit goods or services. While you may be punished after the fact for engaging in an illegal transaction, there is no third-party gatekeeper that can prevent the transaction because transactions are peer-to-peer. This even includes the very governments that may be issuing the cash notes. Finally, cash is private. Because cash is peer-to-peer, there need not be more witnesses to a transaction than its participants. Sometimes the case that only one party to a transaction is witness to it, such as when one drops a bill into a church's donation box. There also need not be any record made of the transaction, since possession of the cash is what matters, and not any ledger entry. So cash is a bearer, peer-to-peer, permissionless, and privacy-preserving form of money. It is an ancient technology with striking features, yet there is a movement afoot to eliminate it. The cashless society. It is easy to take cash for granted. When people think of money, they imagine colorful paper notes, even though the vast majority of global money stock is composed of electronic entries in bank ledgers, not physical cash. The ability to use an ATM to convert some of those ledger entries into paper that can then be used to pay at a newsstand, privately and permissionlessly, is as second nature as breathing. Yet there's no reason why that has to be the case. Sweden, for example, is fast becoming a cashless society. According to its central bank, cash transactions accounted for only 2% of the value of all payments made in 2015, and that figure is expected to drop to 0.5% by 2020. A majority of bank branches in Sweden no longer keep cash on hand, and ATMs are increasingly rare. Other Nordic countries like Norway, Denmark, Iceland, and Finland are similarly situated. South Korea targets 2020 for phasing out paper notes and coins. Citizens in these countries rely on card and mobile payment systems owned and operated by banks and financial technology or fintech firms. These companies have an interest in promoting an increasingly cashless society. Every cash transaction is a transaction that takes place outside of the infrastructure that they own and on which they take a fee. Additionally, cash management is not an insignificant cost for financial institutions. Firms such as Visa have launched advertising and media campaigns to urge consumers to give up cash for card payments. Other campaigns are targeted at merchants. In one, Visa offered $10,000 to restaurants and food trucks that committed to stop accepting cash. As Visa UK put it, these campaigns are part of a, quote, long-term strategy to make cash peculiar by 2020, end quote. Central banks also have an interest in eliminating cash. Doing so would grow the monetary policy tools at their disposal. If there are no bearer notes and all money is in the form of deposits, then it is easier to impose negative interest rates across the whole country. The Bank of England's chief economist proposed abolishing cash altogether to secure that option. There are also public finance motivations. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz would also like to do away with cash in order to make tax evasion and other financial corruption more difficult and traceable. Still, critics must admit that cash has its uses. Former International Monetary Fund chief economist Kenneth Rogoff, whose gripes with paper money are plainly stated in the title of his book, The Curse of Cash, nevertheless agrees that, quote, we need cash for privacy, end quote. This anti-cash trend is taking hold. Signs that read, no cash accepted, are an increasingly common sight at shops in Nordic countries. Even in countries like the UK, where cash is still popular, some shops are going cash-free. And as Transport for London's website will tell you, quote, you can't use cash to pay for your bus fare, end quote. On the internet, cash has never been an option. And as commerce moves online, the proportion of intermediated payments grows concomitantly. Market research firm eMarketer estimates $2.3 trillion in global e-commerce sales in 2017. That is around 10% of the $22.6 trillion in all global retail sales and a 24.8% increase from 2016's $1.8 trillion in worldwide online sales. Online commerce will only grow. The growth of online retail necessarily requires a growth in online payments. Online transactions are therefore generally facilitated by new fintech services, credit or debit cards issued by traditional banking intermediaries, or some combination of these. This means that intermediaries have more information about our buying habits than ever before. Although some countries like Sweden are on a cashless path, it would be a mistake to conclude that people's desire for cash has lessened globally. A report from the Bank of International Settlements, or BIS, finds that cash demand, measured by proxy through cash in circulation, increased among most of the 46 national economies in its sample. The BIS also reports data on the substitution between cash payments and online payments, as estimated through card transactions in 24 nations. Only two of them, Russia and Sweden, exhibit signs of substituting card payments for cash transactions. The other 22 nations exhibit increases in both online payments and cash demand, which suggests a lingering value placed on cash's unique features. While the death of cash is not imminent in countries like the United States, it is certainly visible on the horizon. Unfortunately, the death of cash means the birth of perfect financial control. All right, let's hit our sponsor real fast, and then we will jump right back in with the next section, the intermediated society. The intermediated society. If cash is eliminated, then all transactions will necessarily be intermediated. This is because instead of relying on the physical scarcity of bearer instruments, we would have to rely on intermediaries to guarantee all transfers of value. To understand why, remember what a physical cash transaction looks like. I take out a $100 bill and hand it to you, at which point you have it and I don't. And we can verify this by looking at our hands. Physical scarcity, which was historically not available electronically, makes this possible. Begin footnote. If we tried to do this same thing electronically, it would not work. First, I would have to have a digital representation of the money to take the place of the $100 bill. Let's say it's a $100 file on my computer. Then I would have to send you this $100 file electronically, perhaps by attaching it to an email, the same way I would send you a photo or a text file. The problem is this. When you receive an email from me with a photo, you will have the photo. But what about me? Will I no longer have the photo? No. I will retain a perfect digital copy of any data that I send to you electronically. So if I send you a $100 file, you'd get it, but I would retain a copy, which I could in turn send to a second and then a third person ad infinitum. Computer scientists refer to this limitation as the double spending problem, and it is the result of the inherent lack of scarcity in digital networks. To avoid the double spending problem and make electronic payments possible, we employ third-party intermediaries like banks or payments companies. Here is how it works. If I want to send you $100, I don't send a message to you directly. Instead, I send a message to a third party, say a bank, that we both trust and with which we each have accounts. I tell the bank to please deduct $100 from my account and add it to yours. The bank in turn keeps a ledger of all account holder balances and transactions, and it dutifully adds a ledger entry that records the subtraction and additions to our respective balances. In this way, we can easily send each other digital money. End footnote. On the other hand, By keeping ledgers of accounts and recording transactions in those ledgers, intermediaries like banks make it possible for me to virtually, quote, hand you $100. After the transaction, you will have the $100 not because I gave you a token that I no longer have, but because an intermediary made a record in their ledger deducting from my balance and adding to yours. As a result, bank-mediated electronic payments are not peer-to-peer. They replace the scarcity of peer-to-peer cash transactions with trust that the bank correctly records payments in their ledgers. This has several implications. First, it means that bank-mediated electronic payments are not permissionless in the same way as cash. To hold and transfer digital money, you must first secure an account from an intermediary. We do not tend to think in terms of, quote, seeking permission when we open an account with a bank or mobile payments app, but this is what we do. Those firms are not obligated to open an account for us. It is possible that you will be denied an account. In a cashless world, not having an account with which to receive and send money is essentially expulsion from society. This is very different from a cash system, exclusion from which is impossible. Even if you have an account, intermediaries have full control over whether they will faithfully execute your instructions to transfer money and may therefore choose to reject, or be compelled by a government or other third party to reject, any particular transaction you request. As a result, digital money is not censorship resistant like cash. For whatever reason, and there may be good reasons and bad reasons, your bank can decide not to allow you to transact with certain people, to buy certain things, or to give to certain causes. Even seemingly pro-social or benign financial activities can have unintended consequences. Federal laws aimed at curbing money laundering and terrorist financing deputize banks to be vigilant about money sent to certain, quote, high-risk countries. Because of this, charities providing aid to war-torn areas or deprived populations have difficulty accessing reliable banking services and thus getting money to those most in need. High-risk countries tend to be among those most in need of humanitarian aid, so charities understandably focus their efforts there. When charities' fund transfers are slowed and scrutinized, or their bank accounts are shut down, the potential human cost is significant. What is worse, banks' appeals processes are opaque. One lawyer representing charities whose bank accounts had been closed told the Wall Street Journal, quote, there's no in explanation, no opportunity given to appeal. It's adding to the problem in Syria and the Middle East, end quote. Second, mediated electronic payments are never private. An intermediary must always know the parties to and the details of a transaction in order to make the appropriate ledger entries. Unlike cash, there is always a third-party witness to every transaction. In a cashless world, your bank will know the exact time, amount, and counterparty to every transaction you engage in and can build a thorough profile of you. Begin footnote. Institutions already hold detailed database profiles of many people. The New York Times recently investigated one woman's use of several smartphone apps and found that companies were compiling a comprehensive profile of the woman, based in part by her trips to Planned Parenthood, Weight Watchers, and her ex-boyfriend's house, to sell to advertisers and financial institutions. End footnote. This information, especially if combined with other data such as social network activity, see recent reports about Facebook and Google trying to reach a deal with banks, can be a formidable tool. Or, if fall into the wrong hands, it can be a powerful weapon. The bleeding edge of financial surveillance and profiling can be found in China. As the New York Times has noted, quote, China is systematically and rapidly doing away with paper money and coins, end quote. Cash transactions are being replaced by mobile payments, which account for over $16 trillion annually, over 100 times more than in the U.S. The move away from cash in China happened in just a few years. While cash accounted for 96% of payments in 2012, today that number is below 15%. As of 2018, more than 500 million Chinese use mobile payments. Tencent's WeChat Pay and Alibaba's Alipay are the dominant payment platforms in China, with a combined market share of 92%. These two companies have unprecedented visibility into almost all consumer transactions and are using the data they are gathering to develop credit scores for every consumer. The scores look not just at creditworthiness, but at social media and consumption behavior as well to determine, quote, whether the consumer's social behavior is healthy, end quote. What counts as, quote, healthy behavior will be influenced by the Chinese government, which has encouraged and guided the development of Tencent and Alibaba's scoring systems. Beijing sees them as the backbone of a social credit system to, quote, rate each and every one of the nation's 1.3 billion citizens by 2020 using metrics that include whether they pay their bills on time, plagiarize schoolwork, break traffic laws, or adhere to birth control regulations, end quote. Purchasing habits are noted by the financial intermediaries and can be used as an input to your social credit score. As an Alibaba executive told a Chinese magazine in 2015, the company judges the purchases consumers make. Quote, someone who plays video games for 10 hours a day, for example, would be considered an idle person, and someone who frequently buys diapers would be considered as probably a parent, who on balance is more likely to have a sense of responsibility, end quote. A high social credit score will earn a citizen certain privileges. Today, that includes expedited permission to travel abroad and access to express lanes at airports. But in the future, it could grant your children placement at desired schools. A low social credit score, however, will lead to punishment, according to official government policy, including, quote, slower internet speeds, restricted access to restaurants, nightclubs, or golf courses, and the removal of the right to travel freely abroad, end quote. Already over 6 million people are banned from taking flights, and another 1.65 million are not allowed to take trains. Your score doesn't just affect you, but your family and friends as well. If your friend's score drops because of something she said or purchased, your score will be dragged down with hers as well. This means that not only will people have an incentive to watch what they say and buy, but to police their friends and family as well. Not only will there be peer pressure to conform to, quote, healthy behavior, but official government policy states that the, quote, new system will reward those who report acts of breach of trust, end quote. In tips for individuals looking to improve their ranking, Alibaba Today warns about the downsides of friending people with low scores. This kind of social control is made possible by intermediation. This kind of social control emerges naturally as the economy becomes increasingly dependent on dominant, centralized intermediaries. These intermediaries, as a matter of course, surveil and record every action, which can then be judged and enforced algorithmically. The privacy and censorship resistance that permissionless cash affords serves as a check on such a system of social control. Today, Alibaba's and Tencent's credit systems are technically voluntary, but in the near future, perhaps as early as 2020, they will be mandatory for everyone in China. Similarly, cash is currently still available, but in order for the social credit system to work optimally, the government has every incentive to eliminate cash and replace it with intermediated money. As should be clear, intermediation is not without consequence. An end to cash, a technology that we take for granted, will have an effect on liberties that we also take for granted. A cashless society cannot be an open society. All right, and we will stop there. Coming back tomorrow with the section, The Open Society. Again, this will be part one of the Case for Electronic Cash by CoinCenter, or written by Jerry Brito from CoinCenter.org. And I do want to hit, I'm a little low on time, but I still want to hit a couple of things just in the commentary, just because this piece is really eye-opening. Like before I read this, I did not know the statistics on what was happening with, I'd heard a lot about the social credit system of China, but I had no idea that that many people were being banned from travel. And that thing, this is one of the most frightening things imaginable. It takes a serious level of naivety to think that buying like anti-communist books or reading philosophy of, you know, personal responsibility and individual liberty, spreading information. Think about just telling someone, just making a retweet online of a horrific crime or atrocity committed by your own government, to think that that won't be used to keep someone from traveling, to keep them out of good schools, to prevent them from doing business with people, to alienate them from their friends and family, is just, like, it's almost impossible for that not to happen. There's no reality where an authoritative government does not jump for joy at that level of power over people that they disagree with. And it's essentially a just blanket abuse and violation of five constitutional amendments. I mean, obviously this is China, but if we're talking about the, like, this is something that is not hard to imagine in the United States, and it's absolutely a violation of the First Amendment, that you should be free to associate with anybody, that you have the freedom of press, speech, and religion, to think that it wouldn't be used for anything else that it could be used for that would be convenient or profitable or beneficial to those in power is to say that humans are not human. It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment to say that, you know, you have to have a warrant and probable cause to accuse somebody of a crime. It's punishment without charge, without warrant of anything. It's judging. It's a violation of the Fifth Amendment, because you're not giving anybody a trial or doing some sort of due process. You're assuming they're guilty and putting them in a social prison by default. It's a violation of the Sixth Amendment that they're going to get a trial and that you actually get to face your accuser. Like, who gets to see who decides what's healthy? Who gets to see that, you know, I got judged because of a book I bought or somebody that I hung out with, whose views or past, obviously I may have no idea about. How could I possibly know, if I'm meeting someone new, that they've done something in the past that's going to lower my social credit score in this sense? So I have no right to even face my accuser or know what has I've been punished for. And then in the same way, that's cruel and unusual punishment. It's putting somebody in a prison with no basis, with just some subjective measure that you've typed into a software program to literally put them in prison, to obliterate their freedom by default over something you consider a healthy or unhealthy behavior. And I mean, this just is one of the scariest things. Like, it is literally 1984 on steroids. Like, 1984 is not as insane as what is happening in China right now, regardless of to the degree that it is being used. But there was a quote early on that I noted that, where is it? I've got it written down here. Quote, it's the ability to try things one's way. We're talking about personal autonomy here. To succeed and be rewarded, or to make mistakes and learn from them. As with personal privacy, without individual autonomy, there can be no meaningful open society. End quote. Now, I would actually add to this point that it's not just about the freedom to try things your way or to succeed and, you know, be rewarded for that success or to make mistakes and learn, which undoubtedly we learn from mistakes. We do not learn anything from doing it the wrong way and then being handed a reward and propped up on a pedestal. Like being rewarded for making mistakes is not how we learn from them. We learn from mistakes by paying the cost of our mistakes. If we dump that cost, every mistake, every falsehood has a consequence. It has a cost. That's what makes it a falsehood. It is out of harmony with reality. It sows disharmony. And to suggest that someone else should pay for that mistake rather than them is an unsustainable world. It is one that will eventually decay into the antithesis of what society is. So I want to add to this point that autonomy is critical to the nature of human progress. So not just to learn and get the benefits of success and to feel the reward of having worked really hard and judged multiple viewpoints or decisions and weighed the costs and benefits and made the decision and then were able to succeed, to be able to take the reward from that. It is also the foundation of what it means to make things better. Any true disruptive or revolutionary change in society comes from rebels. It's by its nature seen as the wrong choice by default. Every great leap forward looks like a mistake to everyone in the past. So anything that totally upends the norms of society, which historically are universally shown to be wrong in some capacity, like the norms is what I'm meaning. So like the popular opinion is almost universally what is wrong. It's just kind of the nature of human social organization. We kind of fall to the lowest common denominator of how we can, relate to each other, which is always incorrect because it's the people on the end, it's on the people on the edge who are pushing forward that are testing our limits and proving where we are wrong. And that's a hard truth to swallow, admitting that you're wrong. Therefore, any system that allows that level of control or any money that takes away individual autonomy will naturally be a huge barrier, a resistance to that actual progress. So the nature of someone who sees a significant fault, in the way that things are being done today, are almost universally considered fools who just, quote, don't get it. So the people who meaningfully change things are always told they are wrong by the average person. So to reject the notion that we should have individual autonomy is almost the same as rejecting the notion that there is any meaningful change left to be made in the world. Because that level of authoritative control, the end of individual autonomy, would be a massive barrier to any significant change in the way we do things. And that's, I think, not only is that not the case, that obviously there is so much change left to be made, but that it's not even that the society is moving, is becoming so global, and communication is becoming so instant to every corner of the world, that ideas are mixing and growing so fast that there is more significant change to be made within the next century, before the year 2100, than we've arguably had in all of the rest of human history. I think there is more significant things at our disposal to learn and explore and push exactly those kinds of boundaries that the loss of autonomy would reject today than we have ever had. I think we're at the beginning of a massive S-curve in human progress, and we are not even close to the end. So to reject or fight those tools that allow personal autonomy is to sow salt into the ground with the seeds of human progress. It is to kill the exact motivation we have for bettering ourselves and bettering our lives. So autonomy is not just about people learning from their mistakes. It's not just about people being rewarded for their successes. It is also a fundamental requirement for those who are and have been wrong for decades to be shaken out of their ways and pushed into the future. So to reject personal autonomy is to reject a future that's more in line with the truth. And I just don't think it can be discounted, the role that cash and the autonomy of personal control over your labor and where your money is spent and who you associate with can be taken out of that equation. I think those are, it's impossible to disconnect the two. Okay. Then the other thing that I noted was just on negative interest rates. If you want to listen to the last few episodes, I dive into the consequences and fundamental nature of negative interest rates pretty deeply. In short, negative interest rates is just the act of taking productive value from economic producers and laborers, the people who are working to build surpluses for the economy, handing it to essentially the largest financial institutions, who are then paying themselves out of what they owe you in order to give back less over time, which amounts to a punishment for those actually providing a surplus to the economy. It's decaying the value of anybody doing the work that and saving to the direct benefit of those that are consuming and destroying resources and who would obviously prefer to take resources from the economy and then not do the work to give back what they took. It's negative interest rates are literally antithetical to society as a whole. And it's horrific for growth and efficiency. It literally rewards irresponsibility at the direct cost of those who work themselves silly and take the cost of making responsible decisions. It's a whole lot easier to be irresponsible than it is to be responsible. And when you are rewarding irresponsibility, you're just going to make it widespread. You're going to make its culture grow. The effects on society are compounding when you start manipulating prices. What the interest rate is the price of time. And if you think like manipulating the literal price of time in the economy doesn't have massive consequences, you're kidding yourself. So definitely, if you want to dig a little bit more into that, I kind of covered those more in depth in the last few episodes, just about negative interest rates and that kind of stuff in general. So I'm going to stop here, and we will come back to this tomorrow with part two. And I hope you guys are enjoying this. I knew this was going to be fun. I wish I had a little bit more time for commentary today, but this has been a busy one. So we will hit back with this tomorrow, part two, with The Case for Electronic Cash by Jerry Brito at coincenter.org. Do not forget to check them out and follow what Jerry and the guys over at Coin Center are doing. They literally have some amazing stuff. They've presented in front of Congress multiple times, and Peter Van Valkenburg is over there. Neeraj is over there. I can't remember everybody else who is working. I just know they're doing a lot of great stuff, and definitely, definitely something to check out. And we still have a lot to cover left in this piece, so do not forget to subscribe to the show. You can do that on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, all those different places. We're on like 12 different platforms. And of course, check out the website at cryptoeconomy.life, where I have all of this stuff plus hundreds of other episodes going into every topic around Bitcoin imaginable. And that is the place to find me. Until then, thank you guys for listening. This has been an episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast, and I will catch you all back here tomorrow. Until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.